Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Incubator Podcast. This is your co-host, Abir Saran.
And this is Darren Boyd. And today we're honored to have Gal Albez on the line with us. He's the CTO of Oligo Security and covering such an important area. So what Oligo focuses on is on open source software. They're doing an analysis of library level analysis, and they prioritize behavioral monitoring. And so where that gets really interesting is by adding in context, Oligo is able to determine any deviation from expected behaviors, and they can alert on that. And so that's going to be wonderfully important given the proliferation of open source, of course, in today's modern software. So we're excited to have Gal on the line. Gal, I'm going to turn it over to you for a moment, but if you can give us just your background to start with, and then maybe toggle over to why you started Oligo, and then you've got some really, really cool announcements coming up with DEF CON, and so maybe you can go into that a little bit. We'll give you the floor and talk about why Oligo is doing something extremely different in the SEA space, and maybe we start with that. So let me turn it over to you, Gal, but thank you for being here.
Thank you very much. Thank you guys for having me. It's a true pleasure and true honor. So thank you very much for that. And like you said, I would like quickly and briefly introduce myself. So, probably any other Israeli, we're like all of the founders, X81, A200. But actually, much more importantly, we've been best friends since we actually even remember ourselves. Actually, even before, our parents studied medicine school 35 years ago and were roommates and friends. So we literally grew up together and did everything together. And then when we got to the army, each and everyone took a different position in cyber, but actually got the cool opportunity to even work together while we were in the army. And that was, insane. Growing up, imagining those stuff and then being able to actually do it. And then it was certain for us that we're going to do something together. It just was a question of like when. I started my career at Checkpoint, which I was a senior security researcher. My job was basically to find big zero days and go lecture about them. So like DEF CON or Black Hat and those type of conferences. And just in terms of PR, and actually one of the projects, we hacked Instagram, because they are Instagram, and we did it through an open source vulnerability, which actually showed us a huge gap. Like, you know, the purpose was to find a zero day to do PR, but from that, like, we actually it what ignited this idea, the motivation to do it. Because what was super interesting there is that like we found one vulnerability in one package, and at first we said, okay, it's only one vulnerability in one package. There's so many open source packages in Instagram because it's a huge app. And what can it do? But the moment like that we were able to run code, we're like, wait, we're running as part of Instagram. Instagram has every permission over your phone in order to operate like camera, SD card, gallery, contact, like what's not. And then it really like, you know, kicks in the motivation, the understanding of like, whoa, something is flawed. How is it possible actually that one vulnerability in one package do cause a lot of damage, and this is by the fact that it's inheriting the app's permission. So having that in mind, and I think even a year or something before Log4Shell, it's what like, you know, was the motivation, like, or the understanding of there's a huge gap that we want to actually try to solve. So you know, it connects like the background and why we started Oligo. But
that's fascinating. The and I definitely want to get into this idea of least privilege, because when you walked me through it, it felt so obvious, but no one else is doing it, and you're doing it in such an interesting way, particularly just being able to monitor on those deviations as well. So not only are you ensuring least privilege, which is wonderful, but then you can continuously monitor. But just before we go down that path, can you walk us through? So you're going to be speaking at DEF CON, which is incredibly exciting, and a huge congratulations. The use case or the topic that you're going to be covering is germane to what Oligo provides from a security perspective. Can you walk us through what your topic's going to be? Not too much to give it away. We definitely don't want that, but a little vignette.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you, Darren. So as you mentioned, this is a cool new project. It's still, of course, some are under responsible disclosure, but the theme of it, like we called it shadow vulnerabilities. And what is shadow vulnerabilities? It's basically those vulnerabilities that doesn't get a CVE assigned because the owners of the project or the open source owners didn't want to issue a CVE for some reason, or there's a issue by design. And basically, this example shows us how there are vulnerabilities or like real risks that can originate only by misusing an open source and not like a CVE like everyone knows and understands and look for. And this is super like interesting because when you think about it, when we have this type of attack of like shadow vulnerabilities that don't have a CVE, how can we find it? Because all of the other tools that we know and we count on are searching for CVEs, are identifying by a CVE. So what do you do when you don't have a CVE? Are you completely blind? And that's why, like, you know, it's really emphasizing our approach that like we do the security very differently. We don't care about a specific CVE or a specific attack. We only care about the way, like the least privileges approach, the way that a library should behave. And there, if there's a deviation from its legitimate behavior and catch it by that. So that's super cool because we hacked one of the most famous parsers in the world, but it's a parser. It should parse files. Why should it do an exec and route, like run external code, which is a deviation that only Oligo can catch, while other tools can even understand that it's there?
No, this one's fascinating because we've seen enterprises struggle with the false positives, with just using traditional scanning tools. It's a massive amount of noise. And to your point, just because you have a high CVE doesn't mean that's necessarily where people are attacking. And so it's such an interesting approach you're taking. I love the idea of scrutinizing packages to say what privileges should you have. And then, of course, the continuous monitoring and being able to alert on deviations, which is absolutely critical. It's those changes that tend to sneak up on organizations and cause blind spots. But you are massively reducing the noise. Can you talk to us a little bit about the product, how it's doing that, and why it's so important to maybe start with this if you're going down a security path? Because this is where the bulk of your open source is just so critical to modern applications. This is something we always advocate you should start with. But can you walk us through a little bit of that?
Yeah, definitely, Darren. Thank you. So as you mentioned, like the problem space, we usually like divide it into two. Like, and it starts, like you said, so in the first of every cyber tool, which is like the visibility part, which as we all know, we have this amazing like SEA or CSPM tools that are taking the static approaches and did a great job at the beginning and help your organization understand which vulnerabilities they have in which open source libraries and whether or not there's an available fix. And it was a great start, but these legacy approaches have like three really big limitations that are causing us to be flooded with noise. The first thing is that like the fact that we are scanning code or scanning the repo in like repos or like containers at a cloud level in a static way, we can only see the theoretical risk versus the real ones that are actually impacting us. And even Snyk, one of the biggest leaders in this field, like in the SEA market, they even admit that out of 945 vulnerabilities that they found, only 10 are actually relevant, are actually real. Why? Because when we scan the code, we see all of the dependencies and sub-dependencies, or when we scan on the CSPM level, we can see all of the packages that come alongside the container. But there's a huge gap, a huge difference between what we're theoretically seeing as a risk versus what we're actually using in runtime. And here comes the attacker perspective and saying, hey, if some packages aren't really loaded or aren't really running, they cannot be exploited. And hence, it's not a real risk. And it might be critical. But the real question is, okay, I have a critical vulnerability, but what's the likelihood of that to happen? And if it's like critical, like 10 out of 10, super scary, but the likelihood is zero, when you multiply it, it's still a zero. So that's why you said so. But I would like, you know, emphasize it that context is like the key. And second, we had scanners, we have a CVSS, we have the exploit maturity. Again, great start, But what about the context? What about like asking simple questions of like, where is it running or how it really impacting me? It's really hard to ask, to answer this day. That's why when this approach is started and give a great beginning of like severe CVSS score, stuff that are generic, now there's the need for context-aware decision or doing it in a context that is coming from the application, from the environment itself. So meaning I have a vulnerability, yeah, but where is it running? Is it in an internet-facing container, communicating with data in a privileged container, or is it in a closed environment that no one can get to? And of course, our uniqueness there, and like you mentioned, we took our technology and what we're doing here, it's basically getting into the application itself and showing for each open source whether it's actually loaded or running, or by the function level, if it's a vulnerable function running or not. By that, we can reduce a lot of the noise that is coming, but also better reprioritize the stuff that are presented in your runtime, because we help you to understand where the real risks are at this moment that are affecting you according to your needs and your network. And of course, we cannot forget the last part of trying to actually deal with it or fixing it or remediating it, and which is still manual. Today, it's still a reactive approach. We call it like firefighting mode, because there's a new vulnerability and everyone just gets scared and like, you know, react when this thing happens. But in the end, this process, it's still manual. We need to manually patch or manually upgrade. And now it's something that is dependent on the developers. And the first thing, when there's a new vulnerability, the first thing we can do is actually wait, because, you know, it's some random dude in the world that like, it doesn't work for us. It doesn't have any SLA. So we need to wait for an upgrade to happen. And of course, if we have a transitive dependencies, we need to wait for the chain to actually apply before we actually have the official upgrade to do. And then when we do have the official upgrade, wait, there's so many. How do we prioritize which one is the most important, which was to start from? There's go and kicks in the friction between security team that understand the risk and want to fix everything. On the other hand, it's the developers that has to do it, and they don't understand the value or understand like why they need to fix everything when they are all actually measured upon adding features that are creating revenue versus like, you know, taking down fires as security is asking. And of course, not every vulnerability has a PR and there's an incentive to do it. And of course, in the end, when we do convince the developer to go and do it, and that is a real risk, it still cause a lot of problem in integration, cause major version mean the APIs change. And of course, even minor can cause a problem. And all of this long process, let's just remind ourselves, it's only for one vulnerability in one package. Just imagine how much noise are coming from the vast amount of open sources you use. But on the other hand, the huge awareness that is now kicking in after like Log4Shell and Sprig4Shell and Text4Shell and everything with Shell or SolarWind, and just the profound understanding of attackers that like hitting one chain in the supply chain can cause so much damage only because the fact that it's basically everywhere. So this is like how we start to pronounce the problem. But then we say, okay, we have visibility, we know where is it, we send our guys to fix it. But being like, you know, being aware is actually meaning that we are protected. Like, you know, knowing where is it or sending the team to fix it. What if it takes time? What if we don't have a fix? What if it's not in an application that we've built, but in an application that we deployed or bought or just ran? And now we're responsible for it. And it's another leg in our network. It's another application that can impose risk. What do we do then when we cannot fix it or it takes time? And this is where exactly where Oligo kicks in with the new approach, and exactly what we talked about there. And that like one thing is just to show you which risk are the real risk and where to prioritize your efforts and go and fix it. But another thing is to actually deal with an attack through an open source. But when someone is trying to exploit the vulnerability and get like infiltrate your network, and this is where Oligo approach kicks in, and like our uniqueness is not only showing you which open sources use, but actually how each and every one of them behaves. And the true beauty of Oligo is that we're doing the least privileges approach, meaning that we can show you how an open source can behave or how it behaves in your environment. But the true uniqueness that we're leveraging the network effect, the crowd wisdom, to tell you how the rest of the world is leveraging this piece of code, and by that, we can tell you what is the profile, what is the legitimate use of this library, and by that create the detection or the prevention when there is a deviation from this base profile that we recorded from the worldwide usage.
That's some scary accuracy with what's going on out there. I think anybody listening is going to be nodding along the whole way because it is frightening. Like one of the biggest concerns that tends to hit people is that wait time is, oh my goodness, we have the vulnerability that we think is legitimate. We've verified it through a painstaking process. Now we have to wait for a patching process to begin. What do we do to minimize our risk in that period? And to your point, that whole scenario, which was beautifully articulated, that could be for one vulnerability. How do we multiply this at enterprise scale? So that is fascinating, which is why I love the least privileged approach. I love the fact that you can identify that this is overly permissive and give very prescriptive ways on curtailing the risk. So I think that is absolutely important. But it is, when you tell it in the way you do, that almost gives you shivers on how grand this could actually be in an organization. One of the things I would love to hear from you, Gal, is what does that workflow practically look like? One of the challenges we see often is that tension between a very small InfoSec team and a much larger developer base. And we've seen metrics that are close to 150-1 in some cases. And developers don't want you to just come up and give me a report and say, here's the noise. Here's 10,000 criticals across the organization. Go take out your pieces. That's not sufficient. So what would a practical workflow look like when Oligo is in place? And how can these two teams really work together?
Great question and like great perspective on this problem. Because like you said, so this problem, it's not someone's problem or like one persona in the organization problem. It's like everyone's problem and it's touching everyone. So at the beginning, like we talked with so many organizations and we saw there's like different roles that can deal with this problem. We heard, of course, about the application security teams or DevSecOps personas or cloud security teams. But then we heard about like security champions and like there's so many. So the thing that we just started doing is just going to the organization and say, hey, guys, who suffered from Log4Shell? And actually, everyone just raised their hands. So this is like what actually showed us how this problem touches everyone in the dev lifecycle, like from the developers themselves that need to fix it and doing a lot of manual triage, understanding like, are we actually impacted? Are we running the vulnerable function? Can we get with the parameter to the vulnerable function, asking those questions and doing it in a manual way? And by that really suffer from like, you know, upgrading, breaking changes. They just hate doing it. And it's not like what they're measured upon or like, you know, a success from their bosses in terms of like measuring them. And then it goes to the DevOps team. The DevOps team need to keep the environment up and running. And they're responsible for other applications that are deployed for services. And what about Log4Shell in there or patching them? They're also suffering from that. And also they need to run the business, make it running. And in Log4Shell, the best solution people find in dealing with Log4Shell is just taking down application and by that disrupting the business. And then of course the classical application security teams, they are like you said, so always in shortage. And they are the ones that are usually trying to prioritize this, but it's so hard to prioritize when just someone just throwing at you like a million alerts and like, okay, but what do I do with it? Where do I start with this million alerts? And of course, it goes all up to the key stakeholders or like the C-level organization, of course, the CISOs, the CIOs, the chief trust officer that in the end are responsible for everything to happen, for the teams to actually collaborate, for reducing the friction, for being able to responsible of like, is there an actual attack that we need to deal with? And of course, under responsibility, it's not actually the AppSec itself or the development or dealing with the left side, but actually dealing with the attack itself. When we're talking about actually dealing with exploits or detecting them, the responsibility might shift to a SOC and IR team. And all of these like multiple personas are sitting under the CISO that is responsible for all of that. But as you can see, I touched each and every, like, you know, so many like multiple personas. And of course, I can give even more example and different roles. But in the end, this problem touches so many points or so many different friction points in the organization in trying to deal with it. So I hope that answered the question.
Thank you, Gal. Building on that, right? These days, you have the concept because, as you mentioned, it touches everyone. And there's so much that's missing in terms of context out there. So you have the world of ASPM and correlation happening at a certain layer. How does Oligo, so less from a maybe perhaps a incident aspect of things, but just generally day-to-day life cycle, how does Oligo potentially integrate into as, you know, or maybe perhaps a SEA tool right into ASPM, again, to build those bridges between the operational security, operational side of things back towards that developer? So you are providing an immense amount of context, but just wanted to hear how that kind of cycle works in your mind.
Great question. So you touched the ASPM, which is another cool you know, hype now, and I think it's also Gartner is now talking about it. It's like, let's aggregate a lot of like the sources that we get, like let's aggregate the results, like the vulnerabilities that we do by the cloud itself, or combine it with the code, and actually, you know, being able to reduce the duplication and create workflows and make it much more operational than trying to dig different lists. And it really depends on the organization and the use case, but there are like a lot of time that we were another data source, because in the end, these data sources that are getting to ASPM tools are usually static, and they don't have the context of the actual runtime. So what we do, basically, our product is also used by API. We can integrate to via any API, or our product itself is open via API, so other tools can integrate to it, and by that, we help the organization to actually use one single pane of glass, but having the ability to ingest our valuable data from runtime above the existing vulnerability sources that they have. Doesn't matter if it's an SEA or by the cloud level as a CSPM tools. And of course, when trying to deal, of course, like you said, not an incident, but actually trying to figure out where are we actually impacted. Being able to see all of the vulnerabilities, but now in the context of where actually they are real, where actually they're impacting you, and by that correlate this and being able to go straight to the persona, straight to the developer that entered this code, can create a very, very fast cycle of, like, you know, time to remediate and a lot of manual work that can be saved in like a click of a button when you aggregate everything together.
So I was hoping you could kind of illuminate an area of what Oligo works on. So one, obviously fortunate to have a prominent cybersecurity researcher such as yourself as CTO. And I'm just wondering, what process do you go through when you're looking across these organizations, across these packages in use? How do you effectively determine what least privilege can even be? What does a little bit of that process look like? Because if you get it wrong, then you've restricted potentially the intended use on one scenario. And if you get it wrong in the other scenario, you've potentially said, hey, this package is actually operating with sufficient privileges when maybe it has too many. How do you determine? And it sounds like you're almost looking at how different organizations are using it to create this composite view, but What goes through your mind, Gal, as you go through determining what least privilege should look like for a package?
Yeah, definitely. So I will go back a little bit and like touch the least privileges approach, because you said something super, super smart and I want to emphasize it. You said it sounds very simple. How come we can't, like, we don't have it up until now? And this is like the essence of everything. When I started working at Checkpoint, you know, and everything I was hearing, like firewalls and network and you know, asking a very simple question of like, why everyone can talk with every machine through every IP, through every port, and like we didn't have restrictions. And it sounds very simple today, like a firewall, but back then this is the way things were done. Like everyone could talk with everyone. In terms of like network and it was a wild west. And then, like, you know, the firewall created this rule, created this least privileges in the network. And then, of course, later on, a few years after, like, we have processes running on the computer, we have applications. what should applications do? It sounds simple. They shouldn't, like, you know, put a file in a very dangerous location that can add persistency to malware. So very simple heuristic stuff that today we call it EDR, that back then was simple and everyone were using it. And today, like, of course, everyone stop it and attackers need to, like, you know, find a new way. So it's like an evolution of stuff. And today, like, I think Log4Shell showed the world that, like, something very simple. Wait, this is a logging library. It should log files to the file system. Why should it connect to the network? Sounds unreasonable. How come no one can detect it? So it's exactly the same thing. Stuff that are sounds reasonable, like, doesn't supposed to happen. It doesn't make sense. It's like a true way, like a really cool way to think about it is like, hey, this is another evolution, another like next generation type of stuff that now saying, hey, this simple stuff shouldn't be happen. Like, let's enforce that. Let's create at least privileges on another level. Like, if it was the networks at the beginning and then on the application, now we're talking about getting inside the application and looking at each and every piece of code as an entity for itself that we need to learn what it's doing. So basically, this is like the best analogy that we use today, but also to enlighten what is, like, how come it's only happening now. I guess it's like a mixture of like a really, really strong why now. It's one, like the cloud, the move to the cloud, everything. It's now, multiplied in scale, like much more software, like microservices architecture. It's much more complex. It raises much more problems. But with these challenges also come a lot of new innovative approaches and new technologies. And one of them, it's eBPF that we use. Like, basically all of our patents are based on eBPF. It's kind of like an old technology. It's from 1990 in the kernel, TCP dump or Wireshark, or even the first firewall. Shlomo, one of our investors that is the founder and inventor of Checkpoint, actually told us that he used BPF. It was back then when he used the firewalls, but along the year it's been progressed and more, and hence the E for the extended. And now it's a whole new programming language. So stuff that weren't like, you know, capable, like we can't do those stuff back then. We needed to write a kernel driver that can crash the machine, or it's like really hard to drive. Now it's super easy to do in a safe and efficient way, what actually unlocks the ability to do it. So that's why there's a really strong why now. And of course, the way that we do it, it's like super, super new and super innovative, because we invented the way to do everything from the eBPF layer. And hence, it's so safe, because we get the, to enjoy the true uniqueness of eBPF, that it's like safe by design, but also now it's super efficient. And by that, teams don't have to compromise or stability or an overhead. And that's why they're like actually willing to try it and then like, you know, enjoy the magic of like how is it so simple to use and deploy it.
Yeah. So Gal, as Oligo is looking to obviously go to market, what is next in terms of the your overall product roadmap aspect of things? How do you plan to go to market from your vantage point? Just some perspectives on that.
Yeah. So first of all, like I will touch the problem. Like, I didn't fully answer the last one, but beside being super safe because the technology do it, you touched about like how it cannot break or cannot break stuff. So it's important to mention that we are very fortunate to be taught and led by the amazing people that invented and wrote Windows Defender. And these guys, you know, built one of the biggest, like if not the biggest detection tool in the world, and they do it in a way that, like, you know, is super, super safe, because they're saying, like, before we actually do something, we gather so much data from around the world to actually be invalidated. We're gonna do a data based decision and not, you know, of course, heuristic or something like that. So having a lot of data to actually say, okay, this is the real profile, and then actually compare it to the real life exploits that are happening. And by that, actually make sure that the deviation that you're caching, it's a real real thing and not something heuristic that, of course, like you said, so can block stuff and you know, lose credibility by that. And of course, harm the organization itself. But another thing is that, like any other runtime tool, we're building our credibility and we always start with detection first. So, you know, being able to just detect those stuff that is not possible today, and just being aware, like, okay, this is something that worth investigation, or just this is just a false alarm, and maybe it's reasonable for that to happen, but in a way that doesn't harm anything, and let us the ability to trust the tool and build our credibility and grow with the organization, showing them in their own eyes that, like, you know, these deviations shouldn't occur, or when they are coined, they're a real alert. So just to answer that, and now going back to the roadmap, so it's a great question. So we are also expanding in terms of like languages we support. So like we already have like Node and TypeScript and Java and Python and C and Go. But of course, we're adding more and more based on demand from our customers, like, of course, like .NET and C# and a lot of other languages that, like, you know, people are like just urging us, hey, I need this one, or I know PHP is still like, I know 70% of the internet is like somehow still based on PHP. So we hear a lot. Of course, the most common one are like Java and Python and Node and Go that we see that are like very, very common. Both in you and all in even in all organizations. So it's like, it's funny. It's like, you know, people usually think Java is legacy, but Java it's everywhere. But also, of course, expand in our capabilities of actually like more and more detection layers. So, of course, adding a lot of attack vectors or type of attacks that we can block with our unique technology and more example of like not only a very known CVEs or stuff like that, like even dependency confusion or stuff that aren't really like classical EDR stuff. The fact that we have the ability to monitor at this level gives us a new way to detect stuff that couldn't be happened until today. And of course, expand to IR capabilities and being able to provide value through alerting and dealing with incidents is actually a huge stepping stone that we're now going to do in terms of roadmap.
Yeah, I was just going to add, you mentioned something earlier, Gal, that being led with the folks from Microsoft Defender. So can you speak a little bit more of maybe perhaps your strategic partnerships as well when we talk about the overall kind of go-to-market and strategy aspects of things?
Yeah, definitely. So we are very fortunate to have these amazing people supporting us, backing us. They're like, you know, we admire them for many years, and we really like to learn what to do and what not to do. And these people, you know, been there, done that. So, you know, having the ability to, you know, talk with Shlomo that, you know, forges the market and, you know, invented so much stuff. And also from the runtime aspect, like, you know, like the WAF itself or like or Palo or Aqua, and has so much experience. It's just insane and strategically wise. But also now from a different perspective, like we have Moti or Offer, two amazing people. They were like the chief strategy for Microsoft and GM of engineering, and that are actually helping us in like forging the product and the roadmap, but also how to build it for scale. We were built for scale from first day. We always wanted to solve this problem in a large scale and not just, you know, back at our basement. And also being led by amazing individual people from Google. Eyal Manori was the former GM of Google Cloud and one of the people that he's been dealing with Istio and the foundation of eBPF itself. Like he was responsible for like BCC, the first ever compiler to eBPF. So, you know, just being like surrounding yourself in amazing leaders that are also came from a tech perspective that can give us a lot of value, strategic value. Of course, Adisha Rabbani, one of our investors, is now the CTO of Snyk. So, of course, having these people with such a vast knowledge about our market is so unique and, like, you know, shorten a lot of stuff that we would just, you know, go and find out by ourselves, and it would take a lot of time. But also in terms of like amazing VCs and people from the venture capital world, or like, of course, Lightspeed and TLV, which are amazing and been with us from the first day, from the seed round. But then later on, even in the A round, when we added the new amazing Ballistic team, which are an incredible people that are from the cyber, like they built the cyber industry. It's like whether it's like the first Roger and Barmak, they did Fortify, which is the first ever AppSec in the world, and then like Alien Vault, and then they did they were the CEO and CPO of FireEye, and then like here goes Kevin like the rock star from Mandiant, like Kevin Mandiant from Mandiant, or like Jake, which our board is actually was the founder of Lightspeed, so everyone is so connected, and of course Ted, they're all super involved because they really care about it. They build cyber, they are operators, not only come with the perspective of a VC, and it's like such a true pleasure to work with such a strategic, forward-thinking people, and of course Lightspeed and TLV, I don't even need to mention these big names, and Ballistic is quite new, but it's people that of course build the industry, so we learn so much from them and from working with them.
Your passion is awesome to hear, Gal, and it's glad to hear that you're also supported by your partners and again the strategic investment that's going into Oligo. We believe this is a very compelling platform and look forward to working with yourself and the team and helping you guys go to market out there. Darren, anything else to add?
Just wanted to say that not only have you built something incredible, it shouldn't be lost on everybody that there's obviously a time constraint that you're always doing this under. And with that, the fact that we have, again, such a prominent research, cybersecurity research practitioner with us is amazing. The fact that you are still finding very prominent zero-day threats out there personally as a company is phenomenal. We thank you for that commitment. And then I just want to invite everybody to please tune in and watch Gal's talk at DEF CON. I think it's going to be very riveting and very interesting. So we thank you for your time, Gal. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Thank you. It was, again, such a true pleasure. And thank you very much for having me. And I enjoyed it so much. And thank you, guys.